gives me a huge pleasure to invite Caroline Lucas to address us. I'm hoping that the issues that we're dealing with are the kinds of issues that are central to the policies and proposals that she's now exposing, espousing in the UK Parliament. But I'll leave it to her to describe what these might be. Caroline, you have the floor.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation to speak at this really important meeting today. It's a real privilege to be offered a chance to contribute to these discussions about the vital subject of shaping the future of our food system. I hope today will be an opportunity to share success stories, to talk about how it is possible to change our food system for the better, making it greener, making it fairer, and more resilient in the face of pressures from population growth, from climate change, and from predatory commercial interests. And we begin these vital discussions at a time when nearly a billion people worldwide still don't have enough to eat. Some progress has been made in the last 10 years towards Millennium Development Goal number one, to eradicate extreme poverty and hunger. But a lot of that progress was wiped out in the aftermath of the global economic crisis. That crisis led to steep and shocking rises in the price of basic foodstuffs that are relied upon by entire populations, corn and rice and wheat. And the instability of food prices has led in turn to political instability, to some of the poorest and most vulnerable people. It's led to misery and the hardship of even greater hunger. And we've had more of the same this summer, with droughts in Russia, extreme weather in many other cereal-producing regions, pushing up the price of wheat and other staples. A 30% rise in the price of bread in Mozambique provoked rioting earlier this month that left nearly a dozen people dead. And the situation is serious enough for the UN to convene an emergency meeting of its Food and Agricultural Organization in Rome today, to explore ways of avoiding the kind of market volatility that threatens food security. In fact, let's be absolutely clear, that actually threatens the lives of many millions of people around the world. And so I think as we enter into these discussions, we must be absolutely clear about the real causes of food insecurity and the real causes of hunger. And as the Food and Agricultural Organization itself states, and I quote, "Hunger has increased not as a result of poor harvests, but because of high food prices, low incomes, and increasing unemployment." And the bitter irony, as nearly a billion go hungry, and as we gather to discuss new ways to boost food production, is that there's already more than enough food to go around, despite bad harvests in Russia. The global cereal crop this year was the third highest on record. So there is enough food, but as Olivier has said, the current food system isn't really about maximizing feeding people. It's about feeding livestock, for example. Around half of the annual US maize crop is used for animal feed. And as we know, in parentheses, those animals in the industrialized systems are kept in appalling conditions. We know as well the links between livestock production and climate change, and I know that we're going to have an opportunity to talk about that later this morning. So the current food system is about feeding livestock. It's also about feeding cars. In 2009, 25%, a quarter, of the US maize crop was processed into ethanol for fuels for motor vehicles. That would have been enough to feed around 330 million people for a year. Food for people comes at the bottom of the list, because that's not where the real money is. Food has become a commodity to be traded, and the food system has evolved to serve the demands of the free market and is ruthlessly focused in the way that it operates. It has no real regard for people. It has no real regard for the environment. It has no regard for the security and stability of communities and of nations. The only thing that matters under that current system is profit, short-term profit.
And that's why we must come together on behalf of nearly a billion hungry people and billions more who struggle to afford to feed themselves when faced with competition from the rich world's cows and the rich world's cars. I think it's really important that we come together to demand a new approach to how the world's food is produced and distributed, an approach that is principally and primarily about food for people. And as I said earlier, when we talk about food security, good news can be a rare thing, but I think there are some grounds for optimism. There is a growing recognition of the many shortcomings of the industrialized, globalized model of food production, which Olivier has described so eloquently. A growing recognition that a new approach to how we solve the problems of a billion hungry people can also offer solutions to a host of other pressing problems as well, to rural poverty, to the empowerment of women, and to climate change. But first of all, let me just reiterate and explode that biggest and most enduring myth about industrialized agriculture, that it is the only way. Because big agribusiness would have you believe that going large scale, going industrial, going GM is the only way to feed the world. Inefficient agroecological methods, they say, simply can't produce enough to feed everybody, let alone to meet projected 70% increase in demand for food by 2050. And we have the evidence at our disposal to show governments and policymakers that that doesn't have to be the case. Research that already shows that small-scale methods, given the right support, can increase productivity to meet increased demand. Small-scale, localized agriculture can produce enough to feed us all. And unlike industrialized agriculture, it can do more than that as well. Real food security is about more than just boosting overall production. That is the one thing that industrial agriculture has been good at, some large yields. But successful agriculture is about more than simply large yields. The European Commission's recent communication on assisting developing countries in addressing food security challenges is an encouraging sign, I think, that the EU is beginning to recognize, at long last, how crucial the small-scale approach is to food security in the most vulnerable nations. Its communication acknowledges, and I quote, investments in the smallholder sector yield the best returns in terms of poverty reduction and growth. So small-scale agriculture can provide food security, and it can provide job security. Small-scale is far superior in that regard to large-scale, precisely because it is so labour-intensive. It offers consistent employment to many millions of people, whereas industrial agriculture measures its success by how few jobs it creates. Finally, the arguments we've been making for years about the economic and employment benefits of small-scale local food production are, I think, beginning to find traction in official circles. We in the Green Party have long maintained that the free marketeer's simple formula of deregulation and economic growth equals prosperity for all is a hollow myth. But now we have the FAO saying that, and I quote, "It's clear that economic growth, while essential," we can discuss that later, "clear that economic growth will not be sufficient to eliminate hunger within an acceptable period of time." And finally, there is some acknowledgement that a rising tide doesn't lift all boats, that supporting small-scale agriculture and the local wealth and local jobs and broader social cohesion that it fosters will do far more to address poverty than simply throwing open the doors to multinationals, creating artificial economies built on precarious and unsustainable export markets. So I think we must keep making this point that real food security is about reducing poverty. And the case for industrial agriculture breaks down even more rapidly when we consider its environmental impacts, particularly with regard to the looming threat of peak oil. In other words, the point at which half of the total oil known to exist has been consumed and beyond which extraction goes into irreversible decline. And while some analysts have started to look at the impacts of peak oil on our transport systems, for example, on how we heat our homes, very little work has so far focused on the implications of peak oil for our food systems. And yet the whole of Western industrialized agriculture has essentially evolved into a system for turning oil into food, reliant as it is on energy-intensive manufacture of synthetic fertilizers, heavy use of oil-based plastics, and centralized oil-dependent just-in-time distribution systems. And that's been exacerbated by a major shift to highly processed and packaged food, the globalization of the food industry with a huge increase in imports and exports, major changes in delivery patterns, with most goods now routed through supermarket regional distribution centers, traveling hundreds of miles more than it needs to. Not only that, but our existing food system is staggeringly inefficient in terms of its energy use. Overall, if you include energy costs for farm machinery, for transportation, for processing and feedstocks for agricultural chemicals, then the modern food system typically consumes roughly 10 calories of fossil fuel energy for every 1 calorie of food energy it produces. So under the current industrialized system of food production, our food security is inextricably linked to oil security, and that is deteriorating fast. So what a contrast that is to small-scale, localized approach to food production. And the environmental benefits of small-scale production are beginning to be understood in official circles, albeit with agonizing slowness. To quote from the UN's International Assessment of Agricultural Science and Technology for Development, which I'm sure will inform many of today's discussions, I quote, "An increase and strengthening of agricultural knowledge, science, and technology towards agroecological science will contribute to addressing environmental issues while maintaining and increasing productivity." In other words, small-scale producers possess a huge amount of collective knowledge, refined and developed over generations, about how to get the best out of the land in ways that are ecologically sustainable, ways that involve minimum inputs, that use water efficiently, that maximize soil fertility without the use of artificial fertilizers, and that recognize the importance of biodiversity for a healthy and productive ecosystem. Oil-hungry industrialized agriculture generates enormous carbon emissions, whereas small-scale farmers employ methods which reduce the production of greenhouse gas emissions. Soils which are sensitively managed and kept fertile through, for example, intercropping and using organic mulches have huge potential to act as carbon sinks. And methods which maintain soil quality and avoid overgrazing so that the land stays productive for more than just a few seasons helps to reduce deforestation and habitat loss. Industrialized agriculture does none of these things. It's not designed to. It doesn't mitigate climate change. It makes it worse. And so again, we must make this point and keep making it, that real food security is also about tackling climate change. And finally, if all of those added benefits were not enough, there's the key role played in small-scale agriculture by women. Women farmers grow around 80% of Africa's food. So real support for small-scale agriculture will mean, I think by definition, support for women. It will raise their incomes, increasing their economic participation, and will go a long way towards achieving the Millennium Development Goals on the empowerment of women, on reducing child mortality and improving maternal health. Industrialized agriculture doesn't even begin to concern itself with issues of this kind. It treats women in the developing world the same way it treats people and cultures and ways of life everywhere that aren't compatible with the pursuit of profit. In other words, it treats them as an irrelevance. And so again, we must make the point that real food security is also about empowering women. Small-scale agriculture allows us to make progress towards all of these goals because it's not just a method of production. It's a relationship to the land and to the ecosystem it supports. It's the basis of whole communities, the bedrock of entire societies. It's a way of life. It is life. So I think we need to continue building and maintaining the weight of evidence that small-scale food production using agroecological methods that sustains jobs, empowers women, creates local wealth, and strengthens the fabric of rural communities. That is the effective and real solution both to hunger and to many of the other problems that we face in the world today. So by way of conclusion, in terms of the things that I think we need to see, first, that the recommendations of that UN international assessment should be used as a guide to the formulation of food policy at national and European level. It's been approved by 58 governments, including the UK's government, but in terms of the impact it's had on policy so far, it's been, I would say, effectively ignored. So lobbying efforts must be directed towards raising awareness of its findings and making sure they have a real bearing on future policy making. Secondly, I think we need to see a major emphasis on expanding the sort of infrastructure projects that make a huge difference to the viability of small-scale agriculture. I'm thinking of things like microcredit and microinsurance schemes. In addition to that, I think there's a role for information technology. I'm the patron of a Brighton-based charity that has provided computer facilities to a small village in Kenya. And that's brought huge benefits to farms in very inaccessible areas, in remote areas, as people can then share information and they can work together, even though they're very dispersed, in order to build themselves into a movement with the size and strength to stand up to the global cloud and big agribusiness. I think we need to put a stress on much higher animal welfare standards, much less emphasis on meat-based diets. And finally, I think we need to see quite clearly the establishment of a different and separate set of trade rules for food commodities. I've recently written to Chancellor George Osborne to ask him what the government intends to do to protect poor import-dependent countries from the kinds of speculation in food derivatives that pushes up prices and allows hedge funds and investment banks to profit from hunger. Trading in food shouldn't simply be regarded as another form of business as usual. For many people, it's literally the difference between life and death. So I think at the very least, we need to insist on much tighter regulation of trade in food derivatives. And personally, I would quite like to see the complete removal of agriculture from the remit of the World Trade Organization altogether. So I hope today that you will share your success stories, not just today and not just with each other, but to make sure that policymakers everywhere hear the success stories of small, localized agriculture. I want everyone with even the smallest degree of responsibility for our food system and for the assistance that the developed world gives to those in the developing world to understand and accept that there is a very real alternative to business as usual. I think that's the way which will deliver food security and ultimately food sovereignty to the world's most vulnerable people who've been let down so badly by the profit-driven industrialized food system that has prevailed for decades. And I do think with the amount of evidence that we now have on our side that we will win that argument. We will free our food system from the harmful parasites that plague it. And we'll do it with sound agroecological science. We'll do it with unfaltering political will. We'll do it with pride and with passion and with the love of the land and the living it affords us. I think those are stronger than any pesticide.
Thank you so much. It is refreshing. We will look at the columns in Hamsar with great interest. Over the next years, and we will see these phrases being repeated, stronger than pesticide. I love it. I'm also reminded of that lovely phrase in Colin Tudge's book, So Shall We Read? Agriculture is not a business like any other. It beats to the drum of biology. And it really is that different approach, that approach which enables us to move towards greater food sovereignty, greater ecological stability in making livelihoods is so important. So I thank you very, very much indeed for enlivening this conference. I understand you've got to rush off to Paris to do something equally fulfilling and useful.
It's a conference, not a holiday.
and so we will unfortunately not be able to have you in the afternoon in the last panel. If I might, just a couple of logistical things. In case you haven't found out, the emergency exit is out that way. The loo's are that way, left through the door and down the corridor. I should have said this at the beginning, apparently. The coffee break we'll have now, And I wonder if you could constrain it just a little bit and we could come back in 20 minutes time, because there is a video link from a video report from Jiwa Banya, who unfortunately could not be with us for visa problems, explained later. And that will precede the next session. So we'll come back at 25 to 2. And before and during the break, if you would consider the breakout groups that we are going to have in the afternoon after lunchtime, and look at them on the programme and fill up your name against the different groups. It gives us an idea how to allocate the space for those groups. And if I might suggest, one of the groups will be on governance. And Nora McKeon from Telenova, who's with us today, has produced this absolutely excellent book on the United Nations and civil society, legitimizing global governance, whose voice. And she has a few copies of those available for a very modest amount, a great discount from Zbox price apparently, and she has them outside. So do have a look at it. It is a very excellent summary of the way in which civil society and the United Nations system should work and can work, and indeed does to some extent. So I encourage you to do that. So please, look at the lists, fill them in, tell you more about that later on. Caroline, I think all of us would just like, once again, to thank you hugely for your wonderful presentation. Thank you very much.